Hello and welcome to the Journal of Zoology podcast. This episode we talk about some of the papers published in April, May and June. I discuss the dilemma of estimating the body mass of dinosaurs with authors Jeff Burchard and Gareth Janicek. Paul Funston talks about the importance of accurately estimating the population size of large carnivores in Africa. And we find out how Indian foxes are selecting their habitats from author Abby Vanak. Editor-in-Chief Nigel Bennett then speaks about the first Thomas Henry Huxley review, written by Tim Burkhead. Accurate estimates of body weight and fossil taxa are fundamental to paleobiological reconstruction. But how do you predict the body weight of a long-extinct animal? This is the problem which many biologists face when studying dinosaurs and other extinct large animals. In 2009, Gary Packard, Thomas Boardman, and Jeff Burchard introduced an alternative model for estimating body weight. To find out more, I spoke to Jeff Burchard.
The real issue here is to try to be able to predict something about their biology. And what we've found historically is that if we look at various traits or ecological parameters in animals that exist today, there's very specific relationships that appear in the data. And so if we can then take those patterns that we understand, then we could imply about the biology of an unknown. Well, in an extinct animal, we don't have anything more than bones, so what we want to do is figure out some way to get a size, which is the typical thing we look at when we want to predict something in biology. Then once we have the size, we just can throw it into a whole bunch of the existing equations and predict how a dinosaur might have done things.
So what is the traditional allometric model for estimating the mass of dinosaurs, and what statistical assumptions underlie this model?
Well, the typical allometric model is a standard model that's used throughout, and that is the exponential equation where whatever variable you're interested in is equal to a constant times typically mass, but it can be other parameters, to some exponential power, the allometric exponent. And that equation's usually historically been derived from taking data and log transforming it and doing a standard linear regression on that kind of information, and then back transforming out of the logs to the exponential equation that we use. That's sort of the standard thing you'll see everywhere, that people will take arithmetic data, log transform it, run a linear regression on it, and then go back to the original form. That model means that basically what you're looking at when you do those log transformations is that you have to meet all the assumptions of the statistics of linear regression, and that's something that is important. But probably the biggest assumption that's involved here, it's that you can take the log form of the equation and detransform it, take it out of logs, and that is in fact an equation that can reliably predict whatever you're working on. And that's the biggest assumption that's built into doing this in the case particularly of when you're talking about dinosaurs.
So, in your paper, you compared this traditional approach with a new nonlinear method of estimating the mass of quadrupedal dinosaurs. What criteria did you use to compare these two models?
Well, the real thing that came down to is that how well does the model that you develop, either through log transformation and linear regression and detransformation versus nonlinear regression, which doesn't involve going to a log transformation, how well do they predict what's going on in the data that you actually derive the equation from? And when we're doing predictive work, the philosophy is that what you're most interested in is how well the equation actually matches up to the data that you put in. So most of what we were looking at is doing simple validation either through graphical or statistical parameters to see how well the two different models lined up with the actual data. And what we found was that it appears that the problem with log transformation, that is a bias towards weighting the small animals more, appears to be present in the original equations developed for predicting body size in mammals, and thus for predicting body size in dinosaurs. And thus we felt that what was going on is that the equation in this case that has been used historically would overestimate how big dinosaurs were.
And what were the good and bad points about each model?
You know, it's an interesting thing when you talk about good points, bad points with this particular issue, because there is some controversy about how you should approach this. The real thing isn't about good points, bad points. It's thinking about what you're trying to accomplish. And both models can serve you well. The trouble is you have to sort of check them out and make sure they're doing what you think they're doing, and how well they're doing it. One of the points that we think about this is the good and the good point, bad point is how well it matches up to the data. There isn't really one that's better than the other. It's you have to be very conscientious of looking back at your original data before you judge whether this is the best model for you to be using or is it the other model to be using. And that's what I find, actually, that when I do my work at this point on evolutionary problems, I simply do it both ways. I look and see how well things match up and does it make biological sense, and that's when I decide which way I'm going to go. I don't think there's one particular model that is a better way to do it than another. I think it's that you need to be looking at both as this kind of thing. The end point is trying to have a good equation that does what you're trying to do, and not just dropping reflexively into the old allometric way of doing things isn't necessarily getting you the best model for what you want to do. For example, in dinosaurs, we're interested in prediction, and one of the things that you can get tied into is that you can worry too much about certain other aspects of the statistical manipulation and come out with an equation that has lots of good statistics, but it isn't really that as good at predicting the data. Mm-hmm. And that isn't getting you ahead. And that's what we're particularly concerned about with this model about using it for, say, predicting dinosaur size.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that you need to be aware of what assumptions both models are making and how they may affect the data.
Yeah.
And then take that into consideration when you extrapolate further.
Yeah, I think that's really what the issue is with people is to pay attention to that the models do different things. And, you know, in the best case, they'll both agree. And then you can feel really confident that you're in the right place. But when they disagree, then you need to look at why and then evaluate where your best solution is, at least for predictive models. Because prediction is really, does it match up with the data? Is it going to give us a good result? It doesn't matter how good it is statistically if it doesn't actually describe the data.
To read the full paper, Allometric Equations for Predicting the Body Mass of Dinosaurs, please see the September 2009 issue of the journal. In April this year, the problem of estimating the body mass of dinosaurs was re-examined by Gavin Corley and Gareth Janicek, who looked at the statistical assumptions underlying the traditional and the new model. Hi, Gareth.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. So what makes a good model for biological data, such as body weight?
I think the critical thing is that you've got to have the right assumptions, that if your assumptions are correct about the data, then the model becomes sensible. If you're making the wrong assumptions, then you run into all sorts of difficulties. So ideally, I mean, for something like dinosaurs, you want a model that gives you non-negative body weights or plausible predictions and some insight into how things are generated, but you aren't going to get that unless your initial assumptions are right.
And why is it important to review the statistical assumptions of a model?
Because you can be hopelessly wrong. I mean, the case where people often run into trouble is that they think about the sort of broad shape of the data, but they don't think about the variability. And if you get the variation wrong, then you're in deep trouble.
Mm.
You know, because that's the key to everything. All the statistics depends on having a sensible model for the variability of the data.
And what are the potential caveats of allometric modelling?
I think the simple thing is put in the error bars.
Right.
I mean, that tells you so much. I mean, for the data set we were looking at, if you put in the error bars, they're so wide when you make predictions that the model doesn't have a great deal of utility. I mean, they're just huge. And I think if you have a model and you look at that, then that's the important thing, that you really ought to be looking at the error bars.
So just bearing in mind the amount of variation that can occur.
Yes, I mean, you need to look at your variability, but the key is not the individual predictions, but the variation you expect for making predictions. Once you've seen those, you've got a much better idea of what your model can do and what it can't do.
And in the specific case of allometric equations for predicting the body mass of dinosaurs, which model provided the best fit to the data?
Well, I'm tempted to say it depends what you mean by fit. You can transform the data, so you can do a sort of take logs and do the traditional method, or you could fit a nonlinear regression. And the errors that they're minimizing are different in each case. The advantage of the traditional logarithm is that in the new scale, the variability is roughly constant. Whereas if you're looking at mice and elephants, you know, a kilogram change to an elephant is trivial, whereas for a mouse, I mean, it's nonsense. You really got to have a sensible scaling for that. If you aren't going to use logarithms and do something clever, you have a real problem, because then you have to model the changing variability as size changes. And that's quite difficult. I mean, I was brought up on generalized linear models, and essentially the idea is that you look for a transformation which gives you linearity and sensible variability. If you were a generalized linear modeler, you'd use a gamma distribution, and that's almost the same as taking logs. So you're back to logarithms.
So the models you compared in your study were both based on regression analyses to estimate the body weight of dinosaurs. Are there other models which might fit the data better?
If you stick to sort of regression-type models, then I think the only thing you can do is try and make them more biological, have more data inputs, I mean, different kinds of bones, different kinds of things, to actually look at shapes of things so that your model is more descriptive. I mean, I think the basic drawing a straight line is not going to get you much further. You've really got to think in terms of the volume of a dinosaur or the volume of an animal, what its shape is, what its utility is, and what the information you've got can be put into making a sort of more elaborate model. But I'm afraid my knowledge of biology runs out very rapidly here. So, but I think something like trying to make a more complicated model with more inputs, the more data you put into these models, the more information that goes in, the better the model. But it is amazing how useful a straight line can be at times.
Yes, I quite agree. Thank you for that interesting discussion, Gareth. The paper, On Allometric Equations for Predicting Body Mass of Dinosaurs, is available in the April issue of Journal of Zoology. Reliable estimates of population size and trends of large carnivores are crucial for informed conservation actions and management. However, this information is often difficult to accurately determine. Estimating methods are often practically and technically difficult or cost prohibitive. I spoke to Paul Funston, who, along with his colleagues, tested the applicability of tract-based indices for estimating large carnivore abundance across a wide geographical scale in Africa. So, Paul, what are the challenges that conservationists face when trying to determine accurate measures of population size?
Well, when trying to counter large carnivores particularly, there are many constraints. The most sort of conspicuous of which is the fact that these are very cryptic animals. They're not easy to see. But perhaps more important than that is just their general low density. So the lower the density the animal is in the environment, there seems to be a correlation between that and sort of getting some indexes or some measures of actual density. It just becomes more and more tricky to find them and detect them, and so many of the traditional methods just don't really apply to large carnivores.
And what are the benefits of using indices of population size to estimate carnivore abundance? And why did you use track-based indices to estimate carnivore population size?
Now, the main reason we'll be focusing on indices is that we want to come up with methods which are repeatable and cost-effective and have a mathematic formula or basis which is defendable, which produces, you know, confidence limits that we can really sort of trust and apply. Many of the techniques which have been applied to carnivores in the past, like total counts, etc., they're just not mathematically robust. And secondly, they're not easy to repeat. So one has these one-off counts or one-off studies which generate an estimate of how many animals there are in an area, but there's no confidence limits to that estimate, and it's very difficult to repeat those estimates. So I think one of the advantages of indices is that we can develop methodologies which allow us to repeat these in a cost-effective and repetitive sort of way.
So what considerations need to be taken into account when using these indices?
Well, indices are, you know, only as robust as how well they're calibrated. So I think one of our big focuses is on calibration.
Right.
And that is the sort of real challenge is, you know, if we do want to get an index for an area, we want to work out some sort of mathematical relationship between that index and absolute abundance or real abundance. And that is more challenging, you know, coming up with a few study sites where one has enough confidence in the work that's been done, which is more expensive generally and perhaps takes longer, to develop those robust estimates of actually what is there and then to look at how an index applies relative to those counts.
So as you mentioned, these indices may vary across different sites and with different population densities. So how did you go about testing these indices?
One of the key things that we wanted to understand about these indices is what sort of mathematical relationship would there be? We understand that there's an inherent relationship between carnivore abundance and prey abundance. We also understand that carnivore home range size increases as prey abundance decreases. But these relationships are generally not linear. They often have an exponential component to them. As prey density declines, so carnivore abundance, you know, tends to decline in a sort of an exponential way.
Mm-hmm.
So from the track indices, we wanted to determine, well, what sort of pattern would we have? And in fact, what we found is that kind of counterintuitively, in a way, the relationship between abundance and counts of tracks was largely linear. And it didn't really matter what the actual density of the carnivores was in the area, but the relationship tended to remain linear. With one very important caveat, and the important caveat was the difference in some of the sort of fundamental substrates.
Mm-hmm.
So this technique really suited and is well calibrated to sandy soils where one has probably a higher probability of detecting tracks. But as the soils become harder and becomes the probability of finding cracks becomes lower, one needs another set of, you know, equations or relationships for those sorts of soils. So that's one of the key things that you highlight in the papers, the difference between a sandy and a clay-based soils. There's two sort of major different soil types.
And how did the track-based indices compare with actual carnivore densities?
We found a strikingly good correlation between the two, but with that important caveat, the sort of the substrate type. If we just mixed all the data and we looked against track indices against carnivore indices, it wasn't as tight a relationship. But when we said, okay, well, let's limit our analysis to areas which have similar soil types, and we just took sandy and clay as two major different African soil types, and then we found much more robust correlations between the indices and the actual abundances.
And following this, what recommendations do you have on the design of track-based surveys?
Yeah, the key thing that we sort of look at is how much effort is required. And we talk a little bit about that, and the effort does seem to go up quite exponentially. So as one gets into lower and lower abundance areas, the actual effort that one has to put into the surveying work increases quite dramatically. And roughly, we find that once in a particular survey, once you found 30 track events, i.e. you found sort of 30 times you found fresh spoor, not necessarily of individuals, but of groups as well, once you get to that point, the inherent sort of variation in the data starts to stabilize, and you start to reach a sort of an asymptote in terms of the variability in the data. And that seems to be the key thing, is that, you know, if you do want to have a robust estimate, you must have accounted for the inherent variation or variability in the data. And that sort of number of about 30 track events does seem to be kind of the sort of magic number, that once you get to that point. So in some systems, you might get there just after a couple of hundred kilometers of transits. But in very low abundance areas, like in the Southern Kalahari, we found that we had to sort of drive about 3,000 kilometers before we reach that sort of number of counts. And that's quite an important consideration in terms of the design and amount of time that a survey will take.
Thank you for speaking to us about this new, useful method for estimating large carnivore abundance, Paul. Paul's study, Substrate and Species Constraints on the Use of Track Incidences to Estimate African Large Carnivore Abundance, is available in the May issue of the journal. Knowing how animals use their environment and what factors may influence their habitat use is an important part of many conservation management strategies, particularly when the animal in question inhabits fragmented or human-dominated landscapes. Unfortunately, this habitat preference information is lacking for many of the species and landscapes of the developing world. To find out more about one such species, Abhi Vanak and Matt Gompa investigated the space use patterns of the Indian fox, a little-known endemic candid of the Indian subcontinent. And I asked Abhi Vanak more about this research. So why is it important to gather information on the habitat selection dynamics of a species?
So other than the obvious reason of determining habitat requirements and preferences, it's also equally important to understand the scale at which animals make behavioral decisions. For example, animals could require undisturbed wilderness areas, free of human disturbance for breeding. So at a landscape scale, they would select home ranges that included these habitats. But at a finer scale, say that of daily foraging, they may tolerate certain disturbances such as roads or human habitation. So if you ignored scale when examining habitat selection, you'd be missing critical information about how animals actually use their environment.
And why did you choose to study the habitat selection and spatial use of the Indian fox?
For several reasons. One was that the Indian fox is endemic to the Indian subcontinent, and it is also one of the most widespread canid species in India. And yet, we know very little about its basic ecology. Like many other small carnivores, it has slipped under the radar in terms of scientific research in India. So ours was actually one of the first comprehensive studies of this species. And secondly, and more importantly, the habitat in which we carried out the study, the semi-arid grasslands of the Indian peninsula, have also been largely ignored by the scientific and conservation community. So by studying habitat selection of the Indian fox, we obtain ecological information not only about the species, but also about the habitat that it occupies.
So what did you hope to find out about the habitat selection dynamics of the Indian fox?
Well, we wanted to determine the importance of grasslands for Indian foxes at multiple spatial scales. Also because grassland habitats in India are heavily fragmented, we especially wanted to do this in a human-dominated area. We predicted that at the landscape level, grasslands would be the most important habitat for the selection of home ranges for foxes. But at the level of the home range itself, we predicted that foxes might actually tolerate or even include human-dominated land use types. This is because rodent abundance is actually higher in agricultural fields compared to natural grasslands. And so we expect the foxes to take advantage of this increased abundance.
And how did you go about testing the space use and habitat selection of these foxes?
We used some fairly basic field tools. We fitted 35 foxes with radio collars to determine their space use, and then we used some slightly more sophisticated analytical tools such as discrete choice modeling and combined this with information from satellite imageries to determine habitat selection by foxes.
So I know that anecdotal observations suggest that Indian foxes are fairly tolerant of human-altered landscapes.
However, what factors did you find influenced habitat selection by the foxes?
So as we expected, we found that native grasslands were indeed the most important habitat for foxes at the landscape scale. What surprised us was that even at the home range scale, grasslands were the most important predictor of fox species. Now, this was unexpected because up until now, it was believed that Indian foxes were habitat generalists and were quite comfortable in human-modified habitats such as agriculture fields and orchards. However, we showed that even in heavily human-dominated habitats, foxes still select for grassland habitats over agricultural areas, even at the finer home range scale.
And apart from human modification of landscapes, did you find any other factors which may have influenced habitat selection?
The other factor that could also influence selection of habitat by Indian foxes is the presence of domestic dogs in the adjoining agricultural fields and in the human-dominated areas. India has among the highest population of free-ranging dogs in the world, and we suspect that there is competition, there is interference competition between the domestic dogs, which are much larger in body size, and the Indian fox. So the Indian fox is not heavily dependent on grassland habitat, but also that the presence of domestic dogs in the surrounding human habitat can negatively influence the continued persistence of foxes in these areas.
And what are the conservation implications of your study?
The conservation implications of our study are fairly straightforward. The semi-arid grassland ecosystem is among the least represented in India's protected area network. And yet it is also among the most rapidly disappearing habitat types. It also has some highly endangered species, such as the Indian bustard, the Indian wolf, and the blackbuck antelope. Now we've shown that even the Indian fox, which is the least threatened of all these species, is also heavily dependent on this habitat type. So if you start seeing fewer foxes, it's a clear indication that something's wrong. Therefore, the Indian fox not only has the potential to be a sort of an indicator species for the grassland ecosystem, but we're hoping that along with the Indian bustard, it can also be a flagship species for the conservation of semi-arid grasslands.
Please see the June issue of the journal to read Abby Van Ack and Matt Gomper's study, Multiscale Resource Selection and Spatial Ecology of the Indian Fox in a Human-Dominated Dry Grassland Ecosystem.
And now, Editor-in-Chief Nigel Bennett will tell us more about the first Thomas Henry Huxley review.
This year, Journal of Zoology published the first Thomas Henry Huxley review. This annual review series was introduced to celebrate Huxley's outstanding contributions to zoological research. A respected researcher in his own right, Huxley also championed the wider understanding and acceptance of the theory of evolution and inspired a generation of researchers whose discoveries remain relevant and motivational to this day. With this in mind, the Thomas Henry Huxley Review will examine our current understanding of a selected zoological theme and suggest and inspire research to improve our knowledge in the future. The first review, How Stupid Not to Have Thought of That, Post-Copulatory Sexual Selection, is written by Tim Burkhead, Professor of Behaviour and Evolution at the University of Sheffield. In his review, Tim provides an eloquent account of our current understanding of post-copulatory sexual selection, as well as a historical overview of the shift in evolutionary thinking that was needed to arrive at this particular explanation. Tim Burkhead has extensively researched promiscuity and sperm competition in birds. He is also dedicated to advancing the public understanding of science. In recognition of his outstanding career, he was elected to a fellowship of the Royal Society in 2004. The review is available free online in the June issue of the journal, so please visit the journal website to read more.
That's all we have time for now. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to read more about any of the articles featured in this episode, they are freely available via the Journal podcast page at www.wiley.com/bw/podcast/jzo.asp. I hope you join us again for the next episode, in which we'll be looking at the editor selection of some of the forthcoming interesting research published in the Journal.